December 22nd, 2025. Welcome to This Week in Waukesha, the podcast series, a bonus edition since we'll be off next week. I'm your host, Downtown Donnie Brown, coming to you from the office of former Alderman Don Paul Brown here in our beloved Banting Park home. I'm joined, as always, by my favorite producer, the mighty Max Martinson, who's delivering digital excellence from his Cream City home next to his alma mater, the campus of MATC. And This Week in Waukesha is a Civic Media production brought to you in cooperation with WAUK Radio, 540 AM, 101.1 FM, if you live in the Shaw. And as always, This Week in Waukesha, our aim is acting locally, thinking globally. And my guest in this set of podcasts is, I think, a great example of that. Brian Sullivan is one of my oldest friends. We've been friends since second grade in Carl Ed Holmes' second grade class at South Davis Elementary. His first year teaching, by the way. And yeah, we've been friends ever since. And Brian has a degree from Duke University and a law degree from the State University of New York at Buffalo. And unbeknownst to me, I've been a terrible friend. You know, we reconnected at our 40th class reunion. Brian, most of your career has been in the energy business. Is that correct?
Yeah, that's right. So I guess I spent 10 years practicing law until I guess about 2000, a little less than 10 years, and went in-house with a company after being in big law firms. Decided I really hated that and went in-house as a lawyer with a firm that was in the energy business in 2000, and started taking a series of, you know, further steps away from the practice of law and more on the business side. Finally took the law hat off permanently and have been using that ever since as kind of a lens, but I haven't practiced law since 2000. Yeah. So,
Okay.
Yep. So I've been in various parts of the oil and gas and coal business and other mining businesses since late 99, early 2000. So 2025, it's, you know, now I'm the old guy in the business. I started out as the young guy, now got all the gray hair.
There you go. Well, at least you have your whole head of hair.
Most of it. You don't want to see the couch side of the head for sure.
That is it. So, now your current title is CEO of Conuma Resources, Vancouver, yep. British Columbia based.
Yep, we are. That's where our business office for Conuma is in Vancouver. But our operations are all in a little town called Tumbler Ridge, British Columbia, which is on the eastern flank of the Rocky Mountains in British Columbia, pretty close to mile zero of the Alaska Highway. So very, very far north. It's about a 6-hour northwestern drive from Edmonton. So way, way out in the hinterlands in Western Canada.
And you've taken that drive, have you?
I've driven from Edmonton. Yeah, I've driven from Calgary. Driven all over Western Canada trying to get there. Yeah, it's not close to anywhere. So
yeah. So if it wasn't for the automobile, you'd feel like you're in a Jack London book then, basically. If you're like doing that on horseback or whatever. Yeah, or dog sled. So. Oh, that's great. Yeah. And so it's funny because, it's not funny. It's actually really cool what you're doing. As I was looking at the company website, you're basically mining coal for the purposes of manufacturing steel.
Correct.
Is that correct? Yep. And there are sustainable benefits to that, according to the site? Yeah, if you could expound or elaborate.
Yeah, so probably folks in Waukesha and on the Great Lakes understand this more than your average person, but... Mm-hmm. The steel industry, by basic oxygen furnace, blast furnace, has been around for hundreds and hundreds of years. And steel is basically two major inputs. It's iron and carbon. And so everybody understands the iron part of steel. That's iron ore that's mined in, you know, Minnesota and the iron ore projects in Canada. And it used to go through the Great Lakes to steel mills in Detroit and, you know, on the Chicago, the shore of Lake Michigan. So you had the iron ore going across the Great Lakes and the coal coming east by rail or lake vessel. And those two components were meeting places like Gary, Indiana, and on the U.S. Steel on the shores of Lake Michigan. So we mine the carbon component of steel is what they call steelmaking or metallurgical coal. It's not used for power generation, but iron ore and coal are combined to form what, you know, the liquid hot metal that you remember probably going when we were kids driving by Bethlehem Steel and seeing, you know, the sky lit up all orange. That was from the steel making process of the blast furnace. And so coal goes into that steel making process.
Wow. And so for the benefit of our listeners, the Bethlehem Steel plant that Brian's talking about in our hometown, it was the world's largest Bethlehem Steel plant, as I understood it.
Yeah, it was at one point, you know, in the World War II and post-war years, I think there were almost 40,000 people employed inside the gates of Bethlehem Steel in Lackawanna, and that's the same all up and down the Great Lakes when the U.S. was really the industrial engine during the war years and post-war. So, yeah, it was quite an operation, and the Great Lakes played an integral part of why that industry developed, and I'm sure there are places around Milwaukee and further north that were very much involved in the steel trade. You know, you got Lake Superior was a big transport for iron ore, and I think, I don't know, when was it, the Edmund Fitzgerald Day was just a couple of weeks ago, so that was
not only that, I didn't realize that took place in 1975. But we would have already finished. It was in November, so we were already out of Mr. Ed Holmes' class. We were in third grade at Lincoln Elementary. But
that's right.
There's been a lot of commemorations here in the region, and some really good documentaries. And 23 people were killed. And so you'd appreciate this trivia question, Brian. So of course, every year up in I believe it's in Michigan's Upper Peninsula near Lake Superior, they ring a bell. There's a memorial bell. It was a bell from the ship that was recovered. And there's been several, I guess, not digs, but dives to try to, and then it was decided the family wanted to leave it permanent. The family to survive as a permanent burial ground, but they did manage getting the bell up was important because they ring that every year, and they ring it 23 times for the 23 victims. But 2 years ago, they rang it a 24th time. Can you tell me why?
Chris Christopherson died. I don't know.
You're not far off. It was for Gordon Lightfoot.
That's what I meant.
Yeah. Good job. That was great. But real fascinating history. And I would imagine, because that was the big question, is the way they describe Lake Superior, the power of that, you know, in the wind and the winter, that it was like going on any ocean.
Yep. And yeah, there was total whiteout conditions, and there was another ship that was they were given warning about a winter squall, and another ship was within miles of where the Fitzgerald went down, and apparently just took, I think it was, those lake vessels carry 60,000-70,000 tons of iron ore, so it sunk like a manhole cover when it started taking on water very quickly.
And so that was for the steel industry then, that was the mission.
Yeah, it was carrying iron ore probably to Zug Island in the steel plant or somewhere on the southern shores of Lake Michigan.
Okay. So, but now coming back to the present day, and it's going to sound like a silly question. You know, I'm full of them or dumb questions, but so where is the business justification, the model, if the coal is being mined, northern Canada, northwestern Canada, and then it's being brought back, where are some of the efficiencies, if you will, or the fair and reasonable profit centers?
Good question. None of our product is sold, believe it or not, none of it is sold in Canada or the U.S. So all of our product, we're about 600 miles inland. So all of our product is railed by CN Rail to a port in Prince Rupert, British Columbia, which is just south of the Alaskan Panhandle.
Okay.
And it gets loaded into ocean-going vessels, and our customers are all Japan, Korea, China, India, Brazil. So it goes pretty much in the Pacific basin, a little bit in the Atlantic.
Okay.
But yeah, so it's the benefit of where we are is we have access to the Pacific market, where all the growth in steel making has all been in the Pacific market. So the Atlantic market, the US market has been shrinking since we were in grade school. You know, there's been a pretty straight down trajectory since the 70s, and relocation of those, you know, the steel manufacturing business into Asia. So our operations, you know, we have a great resource. Canada's got a humongous resource base in Western Canada, but it's also got a, we're also on the right place on the planet to deliver that to the growth centers in Asia. So that's the advantage that we have being in Western Canada.
And so how does an American lad like yourself get connected with an opportunity? Because you went right into the CEO spot. You weren't like
I did. Yeah.
working. So how did
I
that
did.
all take place?
It was a bunch of guys, I mean, probably six other guys that I knew from 20 years in the industry, or a little less than that at that point, I guess. We had all come out of other companies. At the time, the industry was, this was 2015, the industry was in a pretty rough shape. And so companies that we had worked for, some we were working at the same places, the industry was downsizing and a lot of bankruptcies. And the assets that we now that we ended up buying in Canada were in bankruptcy. And so six of us plus me went and looked at these assets, and we actually borrowed the money to buy them out of bankruptcy from Caterpillar Finance. So again, Cat's got a pretty strong Midwestern presence. And so Caterpillar is a big manufacturer of mining equipment, and they had an incentive for that operation to go back into production because they grew their own customer. So we ended up buying something that several years before we bought it, another company had paid more than $1 billion for it. We bought it for $32.5 million. And so we were kind of off and running in 20. This is our 10-year anniversary. So we started the company in June of 2016. So it was all the founders were American veterans of the American industry.
Very
The
cool.
assets were obviously in Canada, and it had a little. The town of Tumbler Ridge was really suffering at that point. Like a lot of Midwestern and upper Midwestern towns, whether you're in paper or steel, or you know, this was kind of a one-horse town. And we went back in. There were a lot of people, great people, out of work that were really willing to help us get the company back up and running. And so here we are 10 years later. Hard to believe.
So your title should say CEO slash co-founder.
That's right.
It's a great part of the story. Wow, that's fantastic.
Yep.
And so since you are Canadian based and your customer base is outside of North America for the most part, is your company then, and I guess even your work, are you immune from some of the what's the atrocities going on in our own American government here, or this shift to
No, I don't think anybody's really immune. I think the tariff regime, we didn't get caught up in the directly in the Canadian US tiff that Trump's tariff policies have caused. It's been sad to watch because Canada is our great friend and partner and our neighbor, and we haven't been treating them that way. And there were, look, there were some things that Canada was doing from a trade policy that needed to be remedied. I think the North American Free Trade, you know, pact was turned out to be less beneficial to the United States than we probably deserved. Did it require us insulting our Canadian neighbors? No. Probably could have been done more delicately. But we have not, as Conuma, we've not suffered any tariff impact because we don't sell anything into the US. Where we do get caught is when we have to buy, you know, mining equipment or things like that that are caught in the tariff regime. And more importantly, it causes uncertainty globally. So when China or Japan or Korea or India suffers, then our cut, you know, that's when we suffer. So it's causing uncertainty in those places is not good for anybody. So it's caused a lot of volatility, and sure. volatility is not great for our business.
No, not at all. And so you and your, I guess your fellow co-founders as Americans, like how do you navigate the, I'm sure you've, the company's been around more than 10 years, so you've established trust or
that's right.
A strong relay. So you're not running it. They're more empathetic than they are. Like there's no animosity.
Yes. Yeah. There's no, I mean, we're fully a Canadian company. I mean, the company is founded in Canada. I'm one of probably a handful of employees that are American. I've had a 10-year track record of building trust in that community, and people see that I don't, you know, I'm not to blame for the you know, I wasn't up there calling Canada our 51st state. They pretty much.
I would say when I used to work in Ireland, in fact, yeah, you were there when our paths didn't cross, unfortunately, but when I would meet Canadians there, I'd met Canadians all over the world, and I'd always tell them I grew up in Southern Ontario, and like, oh, where? I was like, Buffalo, New York. And they start laughing. And that was a nice moment where we grew up, is we were largely influenced by Canadian culture.
That's right.
And that was a bone. I mean, you know, all the rest of our friends, our college friends from around the country, were drinking the domestic cheap beer. We were drinking the bats.
We were at Brewers Retail trying to figure out how to make a cannonball run across the Peace Bridge before.
Exactly. You know, we had the Canadian Ballet and trips to Toronto and Tim Horton Donuts. At least more than your co-founders, you could talk the talk when you got there.
That's right. And my mom's family, half of them live in Toronto anyway. So
there you go.
When I need to, I can put my Canada hat on. But now it's again, the Western Canada you'll find is typically almost more north-south centric. So there are a lot of people in Alberta and the plains and mountains part of BC that are much more aligned politically they're much more conservative leaning, not unlike the US. Yeah. So the politics are very similar. You know, Trudeau, who was very liberal, his base of support was Metro Toronto, Vancouver, Quebec, you know, Ottawa. But the men on the street, women on the street in rural places in Canada hated him just as much as people in rural America hated Joe Biden for various reasons.
Yeah. Yeah.
So it's not, the politics are very, very similar.
Sure. You know, and it leads to a good point, is just how much, the misinformation that we're battling with. And here's my good segue. So we were seniors in high school and the year was 1984. Mm-hmm. We had Currents of American Thought with Scott Schiffner. We were blessed to have a social studies teacher with two Ivy League degrees, one from Harvard, one from Cornell. And he chose to teach public school. And that was his calling.
I love Scotty Schiffner.
Scotty Schiffner, yeah. Well, it was that election year, Reagan against Mondale, and I was one of those guys, and I have the excuse of being a high school student and, you know, young and immature, and Max has given me the 2-minute warning, so we had a continuous conversation, but I was obviously very pro-Reagan, and you were obviously very pro-Mondale. In fact, at a reunion, you said your dad was the only person who voted for Jesse Jackson in the Erie County, or at least in the South Towns.
No, I think in our electoral district, my dad was, you know, a Kennedy Democrat from the Bronx, sure. And he voted for Jesse Jackson just to antagonize everybody.
In
the 84 Democratic primary.
And I was one of those, I tell people I'm biracial because my parents are Irish Catholic Republican, but my father's parents were immigrants and they were Union Democrat. You know, my grandfather was in the United Grain Scoopers, and they were very pro-Democrat, Kennedy Democrats. And so but at the time, you and I started debating, and I can admit this now, but you made me your son. You like using metrics like why Mondale's a better candidate and all the things. And you know, even though you wiped the floor with me.
You had the last laugh, though.
And I knew it. But more importantly is that I was still bought into the Reagan Kool-Aid, you know, the whole like in today's, like, that's the way the Trump even worse. You know what I mean? It's like, at least I think I'm educated enough or open-minded enough that I could be convinced, but you know, what do we do? Cause I know you've had these same debates with other Don Browns or Gates Browns, as you remember me. And, but it's like, you're talking to, you feel like you're talking to a wall, right? I mean, this guy, this president of theirs walks on water. Like, how do we confront that? Max, how are we doing on time? Actually, let's save this for the next segment with Brian Sullivan, CEO and co-founder of Konuma Resources, as we talk about the current state of affairs in America and this exciting energy industry that that Brian's in, as well as some old some other hometown and other stories we have to catch up on. So
Max is looking up who Walter Mondale is at this point.
Yeah, I know. Stick around for podcast number two here on This Week in Waukesha. Don't go away. Go get a cold drink or use the restroom, and we'll see you in just a minute.